This season of The Francis Effect is sponsored in part by Franciscan Media, seeking to spread the gospel in the spirit of St. Francis. Franciscan Media publishes books by authors like Richard Rohr, Heather King, and Ronald Rollheiser. Get 25% off your first order in the store when you use the code FrancisFX, that's Francis, the letter F and the letter X, at franciscanmedia.org. That's franciscanmedia.org. This season of The Francis Effect is brought to you by Liturgical Press in Collegeville, Minnesota. Liturgical Press is a trusted publisher of resources on liturgy, scripture, theology, and spirituality, evolving to serve the changing needs of the Christian church. They produce resources for pastoral leaders, teachers, engaged learners, and all readers looking for quality books on faith and culture. Lit Press books are available at your favorite book retailer and online at litpress.org. That's litpress.org. Hello, and welcome to the Francis Effect Podcast. My name is David Dalt. I host a radio show called Things Not Seen about culture and faith, and I'm an assistant professor of Christian spirituality at the Institute of Pastoral Studies at Loyola University, Chicago. I'm here with my friends Heidi Schlumpf and Father Dan Horan. Heidi is senior correspondent at National Catholic Reporter, a publication that connects Catholics to church, faith, and the common good with independent news, analysis, and spiritual reflection. Father Dan is professor of philosophy, religious studies, and theology, and director of the Center for the Study of Spirituality at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana. He's also affiliated professor of spirituality at the Oblate School of Theology in San Antonio, Texas. Every couple of weeks, we get together to discuss news and events through a lens of our shared Catholic faith. Father Dan and Heidi, welcome to you both. Heidi, how have you been?
I am well. Good to see you guys again. Our listeners, may not know this, but we're recording a little bit early because of people's travel schedule. So it's just lovely to see you guys on a Friday. I will tell you, here's something that happened to me yesterday. You know, city living, right? Have you ever had your bike stolen?
I have, actually. No. When I was in Nashville, I had a bike stolen. Yeah. Did that happen to you?
My husband's bike was stolen yesterday. They Bummer. Cut the lock and stole it. On his birthday.
Oh.
Isn't that sad? And that walk of shame home where you're carrying your helmet and you don't have your bike is so sad. So I tried to make yesterday extra special for him because he was kind of sad. And he's not a listener to the podcast, I'll tell you, but I think his brother is. So, but yeah, no, we're doing well here. I've been busy at work working on some interesting stories that you can see at NCR. I'm preparing to go to a conference next week at Loyola. I believe it's at the Lakeshore campus on environmental sustainability. So if any of our listeners are going to be out there, look for me and say hi. But I was kind of just part of my Lenten practice is reading, and I am a judge for the Catholic Media Association Book Awards. I have a couple categories. I have 21 books that I need to read by April 8th. I started on March 1st. I'm on the third one only. I need to kind of take it up a notch. So I'll let you know how that's going. How about you, Dan? How are you doing?
Well, the cat's out of the bag. Since we're recording early, I will admit to being the culprit whose schedule does not allow us to record at our normal weekly recording time. That's because, thanks be to God, we're beginning our spring break. As you're listening to this, we'll be kind of heading toward the end of spring break, but Notre Dame and St. Mary's and Holy Cross College, the tri-campus community, we all have synced calendars and our time has come. And it's definitely necessary. The students are tired. The faculty are tired. The squirrels on campus are tired. Everyone needs a break. So it's welcome. And I'll be doing a little traveling. So mea culpa, if some breaking news happens that would have been in the podcast, you can all blame me. But I'm so delighted to be with my friends and colleagues, David and Heidi here, because we support one another. I think I'm not spilling any milk here when I say that Heidi's going to throw us off down the road too. So we travel. The only person who's not throwing us off is David because of his glorious sabbatical. But speaking of that, I just want to mention a couple of things that are coming up after our spring break. So as you're listening to this on Thursday, next week on Tuesday, March 9th, I'll be speaking with Professor Bernie McGinn. The two of us are co-presenting in a series on the history of Christian mysticism for the World Center for Christian Meditation, an international organization. They're hosting this online webinar, and we'll be talking about the mysticism of Francis and Clare of Assisi. Then the next day, Wednesday, March 20th, we here at the Center for the Study of Spirituality are hosting Dr. Jason Steedle-Jack, who is a professor in New York City, and he's going to do a book event and talk about his book on the history of LGBTQ ministry in the Catholic Church. So that, I think, really pairs well with our guest today that David will talk about in just a moment. And in the spirit of David, before I turn to you, I'm always reluctant to talk about writing projects and this kind of stuff. I don't know. I usually give my spiel here, and then David, you talk about where you are and what great ideas you have coming and all these kind of forthcoming projects. And I'm like, oh man, I never talk about this. So I remembered this time to say something. Last week, my colleague, Dr. Jessica Koblenz, and I submitted a manuscript to Paulus Press for a volume that's going to come out next spring titled Women Responding to the Spirit, Selections from the Madaliva Lectures. So 2024 to 2025 academic year is the 40th anniversary of the founding of the Center for the Study of Spirituality. And we are planning lots of big events. And one of the projects that has been in the works for a couple of years is bringing together a kind of one volume book that would contain sort of the highlights, the best of from these 40 years. So we're really excited about that. Now that manuscript is off our plates, as it were, and in the hands of our wonderful editors, happy to share that good news in the spirit of David Dalt. So now, enough of me. Let's turn to David Dalt.
Well, I am delighted to hear about that project with Jess Koblenz, who I'm a big fan of her work, I'm a big fan of your work, and I'm a big fan of the Madaliva Lectures, so I'm glad to know that all of this is coming together and will be coming out into the world because I and others will benefit from it. I am on sabbatical, which means I have a lot of projects to finish, and a colleague of mine, Lauren Schwer, who's in the Office of Mission at Loyola, puts together at the beginning of spring break every year a writing retreat for faculty. So this is the second year that I went on that. So I was gone for 3 days and focused on a pivotal chapter in the revision of the Accessorized Bible for Yale Press. I stayed with it for 2 days, kind of re-outlining it. And now I figured out the right structure for it, and it's going to set up the next revisions of chapters that need to happen. So it's all going well, and I've got half of it drafted now, and the other 3,000 words are going to be coming over the next few days. So I kind of know what I'm going to be saying, and it's all in 200-word chunks, so it's all going to fit together and work. And the other good news that I've gotten just within the last 24 hours is I've been approved for spring of 2025 to plan and run a new course at Loyola on nuclear security and Catholic social teaching. Listeners may be aware that Pope Francis has moved the needle for Catholic social teaching on the question of nuclear weapons from a kind of balanced approach where we understand that these are morally evil, but we also recognize that we can't necessarily say to nations that they are forbidden to possess them. Pope Francis has now declared that they are forbidden to be possessed. And so the sort of outgrowth of those declarations from the Vatican, I think, will make for very interesting conversations in the course. And the goal of the course is to train students to become informed advocates in the public sphere so that they can use Catholic social teaching to actually speak in an informed way, but in a manner where those who are on the policy side will take them seriously because they will sound like they know what they're talking about, instead of just saying, which is often the case, nukes bad. But they'll be able to say with some technical detail why nukes are bad from a policy level. That's the goal of the course. So I'm very excited about all of this and just happy to be doing this.
I want to take that class.
You can. You can.
I can?
Yeah. The way that the dean and I talked about it, there will be a certain number of spots that will be open to non-Loyola participants. So there is the possibility for public participation in the course. And for those that are in the Chicago area who are enrolled in one of the ATS schools, the Association of Theological Schools, that's also the possibility to take it there. And I'll be cross-listing it with the political science department and possibly the theology department. So my hope is that the enrollment will be robust and the conversations will be varied and interesting. So In terms of robust conversations and varied and interesting topics, today we will be looking at the kickoff of the presidential race. So we're recording this the day after the State of the Union address and the week of Super Tuesday. So a lot has kind of been set up on the board here with regard to the 2024 presidential race. We'll also be looking at the impending demise of Church Militant and what that means for Catholic media and Catholic relations in North America. And in our third segment, we'll be picking up an interview that Heidi did with Michael O'Loughlin, who is the new executive director of Outreach Catholic and the author of Hidden Mercy and the Plague podcast. So we're looking forward to all of that coming up. But we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Francis Effect. We'll be back in just a moment.
Welcome back to The Francis Effect. I'm Dan Horan, and I'm here with Heidi Schlumpf and David Dalt. Every couple of weeks, we get together to discuss news and events from a lens of our Catholic faith. Earlier this month, following Super Tuesday, former U.S. Ambassador and former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley suspended her presidential campaign. This cleared the way for former President Donald Trump to become the presumptive Republican nominee. With that, we can now say that the 2024 race for the U.S. presidency has officially begun. There will still be primaries and conventions ahead, but we know who the two candidates will be. On the Democratic Party side, current President Joe Biden has faced no serious contenders, but that doesn't mean he has not faced challenges. Over 100,000 voters cast their ballot for, quote, uncommitted in the recent Michigan primary. This was part of a coordinated effort by activists to protest the role of the United States in the current conflict in the Middle East. The protests continued into Super Tuesday with a substantial effect in the Minnesota primary. As a result, 11 Minnesota delegates, alongside two from Michigan, will represent the protest at the Democratic National Convention in August. We're taping this episode the morning after President Biden delivered the State of the Union address to Congress. And also, as we have covered at several points before on the podcast, former President Trump continues to face legal peril with multiple civil, state, and federal criminal trials working their way through the court system in advance of the November election. David, there are so many moving parts here. Where should we be keeping our focus?
Well, the first thing that I want to highlight is circling back to those primaries in Michigan and Minnesota where the protest movement to vote for uncommitted really kind of made an impact and was part of the news cycle for a couple of days. Now, on its surface level, 100,000 voters may not seem like a lot in a contest that's going to be, you know, decided by millions and millions of voters. But in these particular states, those were states where the margin between Donald Trump and President Biden the last time that they faced off was razor thin. And so one concern is any amount of votes that could swing or people not showing up could make a significant difference in terms of a winner-take-all sort of situation in a state. The other thing that has begun to be talked about in the news reports is these weren't just any voters. The voters who really were involved in these protest campaigns are influencer voters. They're the ones that are getting other people out to vote on election day. And so the impact that they could have on the 2024 election in the fall could be significant. So I think that the hope is that they have gotten the attention of some people in the Democratic Party to actually come to the table and begin to negotiate around policy and to move the policy needle in a direction on the Middle East. The other thing is because of the Super Tuesday blowout that Donald Trump had against Nikki Haley when she suspended her campaign, the State of the Union address, which you mentioned happened last night as we're taping this, really became President Biden's first national campaign speech. And I think it's fair to say he came out swinging. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on that particularly.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, it was my husband's birthday, and our exciting evening was to watch the State of the Union together. We're both political junkies. But yeah, I was pretty impressed. He looks his age, but he certainly had a lot of energy and seemed to me to say all the right things. I was also reading this morning that apparently they were like closing up turning the lights off, and he was still there chatting with people towards the end of the night. So I think he was definitely trying to portray himself as somebody who could overcome the issue of his age and who was making people feel good about things that are going right in America, things that his administration has done, and setting it up in the beginning as we need to reclaim our country, and talked about January 6th and how we need to still be a democracy and we need to reclaim our country on the world stage, and talked about Ukraine. I don't know if people stayed up to watch the Republican response. Yeah, from, what was her name? Katie Britt, right?
Yeah.
She was definitely a different voice, and her issues that she brought up were different, right? So the fear around immigration, the fear around economic issues. And it just seemed to me that she was selected to try to speak to that suburban mom demographic that has been so important in the past and will probably continue to be important. So yeah, it felt like between Super Tuesday and the State of the Union last night, we are into heavy campaign season now. Yeah.
Yeah, that's undeniable. Even I mentioned at the top of this segment that Biden hasn't faced any kind of serious contenders. There was one who was kind of still in the mix, but he also dropped out this past week. And so it really is a fait accompli when it comes to Trump and Biden. It's a rematch of 2020. I have lots of thoughts about that. But just on the topic of the State of the Union, I didn't stay up to watch it. I don't anymore, mostly because because I'm an old man and an early bird. And so I like look forward to the highlights that the Washington Post and the New York Times will convey, and then things I can see on YouTube and that sort of thing, the summaries, the key points, and the breakdowns. I appreciate the journalists like yourself, Heidi, who do kind of stick through it. But I was listening on my way into campus this morning to the New York Times podcast, The Daily, as is my practice, and it was all about the State of the Union. And I was very impressed, not having seen the visual. I mean, Biden looks like his age, as you said, but he sounded good. He sounded like himself. He sounded energetic. And I think what I was most impressed by was his sort of dexterity in responding to the hecklers, the Marjorie Taylor Greens, who are the kind of like the most obnoxious, I would say, of anybody in that hall. But even he handled that well, which I think for naysayers who say he's not all with it, or he's too slow or too old or what have you, all these kind of accusations that are being thrown about, I think not only being able to bring the energy with a prepared teleprompted speech, but also to be able to pivot that quickly is really quite impressive. It's not something that somebody half his age can do quite easily, to be honest. The other thing I'll say is, and I only thought about this in light of our conversation just now, is that maybe there's a hidden advantage now that the primary is effectively behind us, even though it's going to be nominally preceding, and we have the sort of main race on display. There may have been a secret advantage to Biden staying kind of quiet and letting people set low expectations about his ability, his energy, his thought process, because now he's just blowing people out of the water. So those are my initial thoughts. David, what do you think about this?
Well, I just want to add on to what you're saying. One of the things, because I did stay up and watch it, not just listen to it last night, one of the things that really struck me, and I had not noticed this before, but he immediately after the speech went into the crowd and was intensely working relationships with various members of the House chambers. And it reminds me of the fact that one of the things that he's very proud of is his long time in the Senate and the relationships that he has maintained there. He has often said that he feels like he understands the workings of the House and can really work those relationships. And it seems from what you were saying, Heidi, that he stayed there till the lights were shut off, that he was really taking advantage of that last night, the face-to-face time, the ability to actually be one-on-one with people, and to leverage those kinds of relationships. So I have very mixed feelings about Joe Biden. I really do, on so many fronts. But in this particular case, he definitely has been showing that he is able to work the levers of power. And he's able to enact the mechanisms in ways that they haven't delivered all the things that I would have wanted him to deliver, but there are moments where things are getting done, even if they're quietly behind the scenes, and I've been impressed by that. I'm increasingly impressed, and I was not impressed last night, if that makes sense.
He was not impressed. He did make a joke kind of towards the end. He talked about his age and made a joke. I forget exactly what it was, something along the line. Some people think I'm kind of old, but then he was talking about early in his career, he was considered too young. But I will say that there was this contrast, though, between the GOP response, and you saw it played out a little bit this morning. I saw at least on Catholic social media, because Joe Biden came out full-throated support of reproductive rights, abortion rights. So, and for the Democrats, this has been a winning issue because the people in the country generally support more rights than are currently available to them. So that was interesting to me. And a number of people were like, hey, how can this Catholic president basically come out so in support of abortion rights and not have any ramifications? But what was interesting in Katie Britt's response is that she didn't really talk about abortion except to mention IVF, which she fully supported, and how she knows all these people who have made their family through IVF, which is similar to our conversation in our last episode when we talked about in vitro and that court decision. So that was kind of interesting to me. And is abortion going to be the issue that it's been in the past? I was asked that. I can provide a link in the show notes by a German reporter who interviewed me the day after Super Tuesday. I don't know how they're going to handle, how the GOP is going to handle abortion. I think abortion is going to continue to just stand for something else. We're part of this group of Americans, white conservative Christians, who don't like the direction the country's going.
I think that's exactly right, Heidi, but I want to point something out because I actually went back and listened to this a couple of times, and I may be wrong, but when he pivots to talking about the abortion issue, the wording there is really interesting because he doesn't specifically say a woman's right to choose, but he talks about rights and freedoms more generally. But in the context, it's clear that he's talking about abortion, but he managed, at least to my ears, to thread a needle there and to not explicitly say I'm for abortion, but instead to say it in such a way that those who are eager to hear it, and there was big applause after he said it. And again, I could have honed in on the wrong part of the speech. I may have missed something, but I think that he really did kind of deftly present the case where the people would understand what he was talking about without necessarily saying it in such a way that he publicly was advocating for abortion. And again, I could be wrong in my hearing of that.
I mean, he does do that. I think that rights and freedoms is code for that. But in the beginning, I think he was pretty explicit about trying to codify Roe.
I may have missed that. I mean, okay, thank you for that correction.
Yeah, I'm curious, David, just to follow up on that, what's your interpretation? Is it, as you talk about threading the needle, Joe Biden famously, especially early in his senatorial career, acknowledged his own personal religious reservations and has always made that point, but has recognized as well that he serves a bigger constituency and the like. Do you see that as, is that your interpretation, or do you see something else going on?
It's a good question, and I hope I'm answering the question that you're asking. I'm listening to this and thinking about this through a lens that I have borrowed from our friend of the show, Steve Millies at Catholic Theological Union, where I think that Catholics should be very informed by their conscience. But when they are in a public role, it is not their role as legislators or in the executive branch to impose Catholic teaching on a various and extraordinarily various population. So, like a lot of Democratic Catholic leaders, I see Joe Biden exactly what you're saying, I have a personal stance here. I have a conscience stance, but I also have a responsibility to a wider population than just that, and a population which demonstrably has not come to consensus on these issues. So that's the way that I'm hearing it. But again, there may be other interpretations of this. That's just my particular take.
I guess at least last night, I didn't see any references to his personal reservations about it or his faith, to be honest. And I think that's a strategy that he's using in part because it works. And all the elections since 2020 have shown that that's a winning ticket for the Democrats to be very abortion rights. But I will say that I think there was a broader theme last night of freedom and this idea of freedom, and we're in danger of not having freedom here in this country and around the world. And he did connect that to, in this speech that was very political and not very State of the Union, he did connect that to, and those freedoms would be in jeopardy or gone if the other option is chosen. Curiously, I noticed right away that he was not using Trump's name at all during the speech, and that he kept referring to him as my predecessor and how things might be if we go back to that. So that's, I think, the strategy we're going to see. There will be people, I think, within Catholic circles, some Catholic circles, who will want to make a big issue of abortion. I just don't know if that's really going to get much traction more generally this time around. I don't know.
Well, in our last episode, too, we talked about the Alabama Supreme Court decision around IVF, and what is coming to pass is exactly what people have said, right? And it is about bigger issues of freedom. And I think good faith partners in dialogue can disagree about a lot of different things. But it seems to me that most people, including the Catholic, very proudly Catholic New York Times columnist Ross Douthat, in an episode of their opinion podcast called Matter of Opinion, acknowledge that he's a staunch sort of anti-abortion pro-lifer, but also believes that IVF should be legal and accessible. And he has like qualms about how many embryos should be frozen and this kind of stuff, which he didn't elaborate on, but he came out quite clearly about this. So here's an example, and he acknowledged that there are Catholic theological objections to this, but that isn't actually really a big part of the conversation. And that if you take that logically to its conclusion, you end up in the same position as somebody like the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court. And so I think what's been unleashed, and why you said Senator Britt in her response, and a lot of the Republican Party has not been talking about this so explicitly, is because in releasing this kind of Pandora's box, not being attentive or careful about what they actually wished for in their rhetoric, they've convinced people that this extreme all or nothing zero sum game is the only answer. And it's not just about abortion. And again, even in the abortion conversation, it means a lot of different things. It's too big of an umbrella, right? As we've learned in the post-Dobbs context, are we talking about medical abortions? Are we talking about the role of certain contraceptive devices, right, that prevent implantation as opposed, you know, there's so many elements to this that they just never considered because they were riding the wave of energy and enthusiasm from a particularly a segment of white evangelical Christians and a certain segment of Roman Catholics. And boy, are they in trouble right now. As you pointed out, Heidi, when you look at the kind of referenda that's been put forward by various states, by elections, including the special election in New York to replace George Santos and so forth. So yeah, it's an interesting.
Although let's be honest, Trump is still leading in most polls when they show him head to head with Biden right now. So
right, right. This is where I'm terrified because for every reason, you know, if age is the concern, Trump is just a couple of years younger. They're both incredibly old, they're old men. This is a gerontocracy. You look at the pictures. When I heard the news of Mitch McConnell planning to step aside at the end of this calendar year, I'm like, you see the picture of this guy. I don't think this poor man's going to make it that far. And so what is going on? So it's disturbing on many levels. I think the presidential race, because of the distinctive personalities of these two kind of sui generis characters, I don't know that the national, it's a mess.
Well, I just want to pick up on one thing that you said, Dan, and that's about the Pandora's box. And I'm going to use an example that will feel far afield from what we're talking about, but I think it'll land. I was reading commentary that in the Alabama state legislature, they have just moved out of committee a bill that would ban all diversity, equity, and inclusion. And any organization, state organization that has even a DEI office will have no funding and will basically be subject to extreme controls by the legislature, including educational institutions of higher education. And the commentator pointed out, well, that suddenly means if this law passes that all football will cease immediately because the NCAA requires every team to have a diversity, equity, and inclusion office. And so the thing that I want to point out in terms of Pandora's box effects here is that the Republicans have shown time and again, because they want to eliminate the administrative state, they want to eliminate all deliberative controls or any sort of depth of analysis. Exactly what you were saying. They follow their rhetoric, they will put laws on the books, and they will not think about the consequences. So the difference right now for me as a voter between the Republicans and the Democrats is I at least can trust the Democrats to think about the consequences as they are moving forward, and they trust the deliberative aspects of government in a way that the Republicans have shown, particularly in the last several election cycles, that they simply do not. So for me, there's a clear night and day difference just in terms of consequences and unintended effects that I think has to be for any Catholic that is coming into the voting booth. They have to think about what are the goals of government. If we're talking about protection of the common good, there's one particular party right now that has a sledgehammer.
Well, I think that's a really good point that you raised, David. And now that the main race is underway, if unofficially, I know for a fact this is not the last time we'll be talking about the presidential campaigns. But for now, that's where we'll leave it. We'll come back in just a moment. You're listening to The Francis Effect.
Welcome back to The Francis Effect. I'm David Dalt, and I'm here with Heidi Schlumpf and Father Dan Horan. Every couple of weeks, we get together to discuss a variety of topics from a perspective informed by our Catholic faith. According to a March 1st press release from the law firm Todd and Weld LLP, Church Militant, the far-right media network that self-identified as Catholic, will cease operations at the end of April. Church Militant, before this announcement of its imminent closure, had been the online media division of St. Michael's Media, a 501c4 conservative corporation founded by Michael Voris. As a 501c4 corporation, according to the IRS, it, quote, must not be organized for profit and must be operated exclusively to promote social welfare, unquote. However, in 2007, the Southern Poverty Law Center classified Church Militant as a hate group for its anti-Semitic views and later, in 2019, further noted its anti-LGBTQ views. The organization has long been a darling of ultra-conservative Catholics, which provided a source of funding reported to be several million dollars a year. The style of the web videos, live streams, and articles was almost always pugilistic and sensational. Voris, as both founder and frontman for the organization, appeared to relish the spotlight and enjoy vilifying church leaders, scholars, and organizations he deemed too friendly or tolerant to the LGBTQ community. He identified as someone who had once lived what he called a, quote, homosexual lifestyle, unquote. According to an NCR report, quote, Voris had previously publicly repented for his relationships with men, even as he led prominent anti-LGBTQ plus campaigns and mudslinging, unquote. According to a February 2024 Washington Post article, quote, the head of far-right website Church Militant, Voris often claimed the Catholic Church was secretly run by an international gay crime syndicate, unquote. Last November, Voris suddenly resigned, quote, over what his board described as a breach of Church Militant's morality clause, with no other public explanation of his offense, unquote. The Post investigated further and learned that Voris had been sending, quote, shirtless workout photos of himself to Church Militant staff and associates, unquote. This behavior continued, and according to reports, dozens of racy images of Voris appeared on a company web server accessible to the staff. In addition to Voris's seeming hypocritical behavior, leading an anti-gay crusade against the Catholic Church while allegedly sending unsolicited sexually charged images to men, Church Militant was sued for defamation by George Lallaire, a canon lawyer and priest in the Diocese of Manchester, New Hampshire. Church Militant lost that lawsuit recently and was ordered to pay a sum of $500,000 and apologize to Father Dallaire. It appears that the financial blow was the last straw, leading to Church Militant's closure. Dan, not only have you been following this case, but you have also been the target of some of Church Militant and Michael Voris's attacks over the years. What do you think about this news?
Where to begin? The details of this, on the one hand, are entirely predictable. It's like a very badly scripted movie. And this has been, again, a kind of open secret about kind of Voris's behavior, his personal style, his sort of deeply internalized homophobia. But then also, there are just things about his demeanor and his kind of obsession that raised questions in lots of circles, in journalistic circles, in religious leadership circles, and the like. So sadly, I don't think any of this is surprising. It's a, to paraphrase Shakespeare, doth protesteth too much. That's with regard to Voris himself. I don't think that's at all surprising. With regard to the defamation case, that's itself a kind of complicated thing that involved a kind of a competing canon lawyer who was ghostwriting an anonymous article citing anonymous sources that defamed this other canon lawyer who worked for the Diocese of Manchester. The whole thing is just quite bizarre. But the nice thing, I would say, is that Father Dallaire stuck with his guns. And sometimes that's what people need to do, not just to get a judgment of $500,000 in compensatory damages, but this idea that the truth is kind of forced out there. It's one thing when people sit in their, whether it's YouTubers or other kind of social media trolls who sit in their rooms and pontificate about all kinds of conspiracy theories or QAnon or these kinds of things, or whether it's a group of people in Michigan who are presenting themselves as a news organization, as Church Militant did, doing basically exactly the same thing, which is a lot of defamation, which is a lot of slander and libel, which is a lot of conspiratorial thinking and fear-mongering. And as you say, David, I've been the target of attacks from Church Militant and Michael Voris for years. And I could share some examples of that as we go if people are interested. Some of them, actually, I've always found quite funny. But the fact that they would target people like me and other people like the Cardinal Archbishop of Washington, D.C., or of Chicago, or of the Holy Father, it's, as one person once said, who's also a target of Voris and Church Militant, it's pretty good company when you look at the people they go after. So I'm curious what you two think. Heidi, you've been covering them and following them as a journalist for a long time. I'm especially interested in your thoughts.
Well, obviously, it's always good news for journalists when journalists are held to be, or so-called journalists, are held accountable for printing things that were not true and reporting things that were not true. And in this libel suit, I think it's important, like you said, that people held them accountable. And so it is good news in the Catholic journalism sphere that apparently this, between Voris having to resign over whatever's happening in his personal sexual life, and I do encourage you not to Google those photos because they're somewhat disturbing, but between that and the settlement, they've announced that they're going to close Church Militant in April. But before anyone gets like too happy and starts dancing on their grave, I think the market or appetite for what they were dealing has not gone away. And already, I think there are certainly other YouTubers and people who call themselves Catholic media who can fill that void, many of whom are now holding themselves out as more Catholic than Voris because he's terrible because they all say he's gay now. And even just like in this past week, the site has been down a couple times. There was a video posted earlier this week that looked like some former employees might be taking it over, but then now that video has been taken down. So I think it's kind of unclear what's going on behind the scenes. So sadly, like good news, but the bad news is I think the audience for that is still out there. And so someone else will probably fill the void. I don't know.
I think, Heidi, you're saying it exactly correctly, that one particular site disappearing is not at all indicative that there is a lack of appetite for this sort of thing. Longtime listeners will know that this is a particular bailiwick of mine. I really like to think about the canon law around the way that we are allowed to disagree with one another. Within a given diocese, there is an official judge who can say whether a text or a particular church teaching means one thing or another, and that official judge is the bishop. Most often, the bishop does not weigh in to settle those issues. And so, where there is that openness, my argument has often been that people of good conscience are invited and welcome to disagree and discuss robustly Catholic teaching and scripture, to kind of come with iron sharpening iron to reach new conclusions and to help the church move forward with the sensus fidelium. Now, there is a different view in Catholicism that says, no, there is only ever one teaching, and it doesn't even need to be judged. It simply exists and floats in some nether region, and somehow these particular people always believe that they have natural, unmediated access to it. And people like church militants occupy that second sphere where they believe that they are speaking for the unspoken truth of Catholicism and somehow defending a faith that is under attack. Well, the gates of hell will not prevail here. We should and must discuss robustly. And so I'm happy to see that a particular site of venomous anti-discussion has gone away, but as you are pointing out, the spirit of anti-discussion, the spirit against, if you will, synodality, is still alive and well. The authoritarian church still has a lot of people who hunger for its fangs.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I have a couple of thoughts. One is to Heidi's point, and then David, you built on that it's the multi-headed hydra, like you cut one off, another one pops up. So I agree. I don't think, to use language that is more often probably heard in circles like that of church militant, the devil is still around. Satan's still at work, and this is the devil's work. I have no doubt about it. When you go after the Pope, when you go after people who are advocating for the love of the gospel and the love of neighbor, especially for those who are the most marginalized, and you vilify them, that's the work of Satan. I hate to sound so traditionalist about this. I think some people like Voris would be surprised to hear me say this, but I believe it to be true. And so, yeah, there will be other people who will take the bait and be tempted to act in bad faith ways. I think the one thing I appreciate about this lawsuit and the judgment is that hopefully it gets bad faith actors to think twice about before they start acting as negligent as church militant did. And then the second thing I'm thinking about is, if you take a step back and you ask, how did they get away with this? It's because we're talking about an uneven balance of tolerance for this kind of evil. And what I mean by that is people like Michael Voris and his team at church militant and like-minded people do not follow the rules. They think they are exceptions to it. They can say whatever they want, that the law does not apply to them, that good practices and charity and the strictures of kind of best practices around journalism are not anything that they need to be concerned about. They're writing stories that are completely made up from whole cloth. There are always anonymous sources. There's no verification or checking. And the truth is, a lot of the things they've been saying about a lot of people, myself included, are defamatory and libelous. I'll give you just a couple highlights here, right? So in September 12, 2019, in a Vortex segment titled Climate Change, Voris specifically targeted me in response to a column I wrote at NCR, and he began with the line, Daniel Horan, quote, the Franciscan poster boy for all things gay in the church. So that's kind of interesting. He's challenged, in articles on the site, have challenged my orthodoxy, which is ironic given that I'm a Catholic theologian and a friar and a priest in good standing in the church. That's never been challenged or questioned. They've used language like saying that I forego the magisterium, that I'm, quote, a heterodox Franciscan priest. But one of my favorites goes back to some years ago, in around 2018, when Voris, who absolutely despised the Los Angeles Religious Education Congress, which is a ministry of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, attacked a bunch of speakers, myself included, as well as Bishop Robert Barron, Father Brian Massengale, and others. And the title of the article is still one of my favorites, quote, Heretics on Parade. So I'm like, it's very interesting that this guy feels like he has, to your point, David, some sort of supra magisterial position where he can call into check Pope Francis's orthodoxy, a Catholic theologian's orthodoxy, a sitting bishop or cardinal's orthodoxy. This is beyond delusions of grandeur. This is a disturbed worldview that I think, using the language that they would be most familiar with, is demonic.
Yeah, well, I'm not a big person with the devil language, but I will say that I think, like, Voris personally is a very complex person with, I think, some kind of sad things, and I tend to pray for everybody. So I think he's in a very bizarre situation, clearly, in his own like psychology. And it's worth pointing out that there's a lawsuit against him personally that continues. So the lawsuit that was settled, the defamation lawsuit, was with the organization. So he's got kind of a long road of figuring out who he is and what his relationship is to the world and to God and to the law. But I will say, in terms of church militant, they were so so extreme as to be a caricature, and Heretics on Parade and like Bob Barron, Bishop Robert Barron, is not conservative enough for you. But I think what's scarier to me is other news outlets that basically have kind of the same practices, but just more with a veneer of respectability. And I think those ones are almost more dangerous than Church Militant, which is always a little bit kind of kooky. So I don't know. As a journalist, we care a lot about truth and journalistic practices and journalistic ethics and other places that don't. I tend not to spend too much time on them, but I think this is a win for Catholic journalism that they won't be around anymore.
Well, and since you won't mention the name, but the Holy Father has in the past, I think you might be alluding to the Eternal Word Television Network and its affiliated wings. And that's something that I know that you did a deep dive on how they are funded and some years back, a multi-part investigative report. So yeah, there are those who kind of launder these sorts of conspiratorial views, these sorts of ad hominem attacks, and do so with a kind of patina of respectability. And it is disturbing. I just want to circle back too, because you made that comment about the devil stuff. I want to just say that I was leaning into that for effect, because this is the kind of language that Voris regularly used. But I also want to say theologically, we do profess whatever people imagine or believe about the devil and how the devil is understood and its kind of satanic symbolism and this sort of stuff. The truth is, at the core of our faith, we talk about the effects of original sin. And we talk about, as St. Augustine says, that we have, because of this kind of propensity to lean toward doing the things we shouldn't do. St. Paul talks about this in the New Testament. Others over the years have talked about this in the Christian tradition. And so to your point about prayer, I think that is actually really well said and warranted, that we need to pray for one another. And my position, as you said as well, is that it's such a caricature. It's so over the top that it never really affected me. And actually, a lot of us who have been targets, who know each other professionally, or some of us are friends with one another, it's annoying, but it's a source of more pity and laughter than it's ever been, like, oh, they're really getting at us. The thing that breaks my heart is the people who may be people who are well-intentioned, people of good faith, who happen upon this through the internet, or who are believers who want to kind of do the right thing and buy into this, or are persuaded by this kind of rhetoric. And it really... It hurts people, and I think it damages their spiritual life.
Well, and I want to speak from a pastoral register now. I think that a lot of the people behind organizations like Church Militant are themselves hurt people. When I first became Catholic, now more than 15 years ago, a very wise mentor pulled me aside and said, "Be aware, David, of the convert's zeal. And be aware that you will now feel like you have arrived somehow at an island of truth and you must defend it." And this wise counselor said, "That's not your job." That's not your job. But I think for a lot of people who have had questions about their identity or have felt upset in the cultural landscape and like they have been losing something that was of importance to them in terms of who they were or their concept of themselves, they can arrive at something like Catholicism with its sort of surface authority and believe that now they are paladins defending the faith. And I just want to say to our listeners, that's not our job. The gates of hell will not prevail, and it is our job to, like the Lord that taught us, to move with meekness and with assurance, but also an assurance that allows us to minister not only to those that think like us, but to those that have declared themselves our enemies. That is what we are called to do. And if we can't be doing that, then we really have nothing to defend. So I really think that there's a sense of satisfaction here for me, but also a sense of extreme sadness, because these are people who invested time and such an ungodly amount of money in a faith of straw. And I hope that they find a genuine faith to engage with as they move forward from this experience.
And I think there's a third kind of group of people we haven't talked about that I think about often. In fact, I was having a conversation with one of my academic colleagues this morning about this, not specifically about Church Militant or this story, but about, you know, if this becomes the presentation of what authentic or legitimate or orthodox Catholicism is, it will only further turn away spiritually open people like a lot of young people today. I think in particular of my students in Generation Z. They look at this kind of stuff and they say, why would I want to have anything to do with it, has anything to do with this, even in the most remote way possible? And they're not wrong. And that's something that the two of us were chatting about over coffee this morning. It's like, they're not wrong. So what do we do about it? I think prayer is necessary. I think also living the gospel as Jesus calls us to. That's the thing that will, I'm remembering a friar I once lived with who's now deceased, at the time he was a much older friar, and he used to say, kind of jokingly, why do we even have vocation directors? All we need to do is if we live the life, people will come. And I think that's exactly how Jesus modeled it for us. And if we are authentic to our baptismal call, then, you know, that should be all that's necessary. But in the meantime, yeah, there are people who are bad faith actors who are causing a lot of harm. And so let's pray for them. Let's pray for those who are targets of their activities, and pray for those who are turned off and pushed away because of that.
Well, listeners, normally this would be where I would say that we will probably talk about this subject again. But let me say from the bottom of my heart that I hope that we never are called to mention Church Militant again, and that this is tying the bow on all of that, and that we can move on, and that they can move on. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Heidi is going to be interviewing Michael O'Loughlin, who is the new executive director of Outreach Catholic and the author of Hidden Mercy, an excellent book on the Catholic responses in the 1980s to the AIDS crisis.
Welcome back to The Francis Effect. I'm Heidi Schlump with today's guest, Michael O'Loughlin. Mike was recently named Executive Director of Outreach, an online publication of news, opinion, and resources for LGBTQ Catholics that's affiliated with the Jesuit-run magazine America. He previously served as America's national correspondent, covering, among other things, LGBTQ people and issues in the church. Mike is also the author of the book Hidden Mercy, AIDS, Catholics, and the Untold Stories of Compassion in the Face of Fear, which described the church's response to the AIDS crisis in the 1980s and 90s. His book received praise from many, including myself, and not to mention Pope Francis, who sent Mike a congratulatory letter when the book was published in 2021. In the past 2 years, Mike has traveled extensively to promote the book and to speak to groups around the country. He and his partner and his dog recently moved from Chicago to New England, so I missed the chance to meet with him for coffee and lunch here in Chicago, but I'm glad we're able to have this conversation here on the Francis Effect podcast. So welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Heidi.
I'm so glad you're here. Tell us a little bit about Outreach. So why did America start this project, and what is the mission? And now that you're the leader in charge of its strategic direction, what are you hoping that Outreach can be for LGBTQ Catholics and for the whole church?
Outreach started in 2020. So the founder and creator of the idea was my colleague at America, Father Jim Martin, who certainly your listeners will know through his prolific writing. But the book, Building a Bridge, that he wrote, describing his aspirations for the church to be more welcoming to LGBTQ Catholics, that served as the catalyst. He heard from so many readers who appreciated his overtures to the LGBT community and his calls for the church to be more welcoming. And Father Jim said, there's all this energy and community here. Let's start a clearinghouse of best practices for LGBT Catholic ministry, a place for community, for people to share ideas, and really wanted to form not necessarily an organization at first, but an online space for people to learn about LGBT Catholics living their faith in the church. It grew over time, and there was actually plans for a conference in 2020 when Father Jim was going to bring together people working in LGBT Catholic ministry. That ended up being online, of course. But the energy there showed that there was an appetite for this kind of work. And it grew and grew. And outreach.faith became a website where you can read articles, news, views, different perspectives from LGBT Catholics, their allies, people working in LGBT ministry. And there's been two successful conferences in person at Fordham University. And we're in the midst of planning for our 2024 conference, which will be at Georgetown University in August. And my goal, with my background in journalism, I've been covering the church for 10 years now. I've been able to meet with many LGBT Catholic groups over the last couple of years since Hidden Mercy came out. My goal is to really highlight the stories of LGBT people who are making life in the church work for them. There's really a vibrant space for LGBT people in the church, and I want to be able to highlight some of those stories going forward at Outreach.
A couple months ago, the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith released a document called Fiducia Supplicans, which said that priests can bless gay couples or those in quote-unquote irregular unions. So obviously, some people see this as incredibly hopeful. Others, including some bishops around the world, disagree quite strongly. So give us your take about this. What does this move on Pope Francis's part mean?
It was a crazy few weeks, wasn't it? So you remember right before Christmas, the Vatican releases this document, this decree, and it is a pretty long document, but I think the media correctly kind of honed in on this one section that said priests could offer blessings to Catholics living in irregular unions, which they made a point of saying Catholics in same-sex relationships. And I think it was a celebratory moment just a week or so before Christmas. I think one columnist I read called it a Christmas gift for gay and lesbian Catholics. I think one of the twists came when the same office released a press release a few weeks later. And this was partly in reaction to some negative feedback from some Catholic bishops who expressed opposition to this. And it did a couple things, which I think caused some unhappiness in the LGBT Catholic community. One was it really kind of downplayed what these blessings were. I think that there was this excitement that priests would be able to offer blessings to same-sex couples, albeit with a lot of rules about what it could look like, that they had to be spontaneous, they had to be short. But the document did allow the blessings. And the press release comes out and said, these aren't really a big deal. These are blessings that a priest can offer anyone after Mass. Let's not get too worked up about it. And then further, the press release also kind of reiterated the sinfulness of Catholics, gay and lesbian Catholics who are in relationships, saying that all people are sinners, really kind of hammered away at this sinfulness of homosexual acts and applying that to gay and lesbian couples maybe seeking a blessing. So it was a whiplash moment, I think, where you had this sort of celebratory document that came out in December. And then by January, you have a pretty, at least viewed by many in the LGBT Catholic community, a pretty harsh document that still allowed the blessings to go forward, but also gave permission for bishops to opt out. So it was a, I think, challenging few weeks for the LGBT Catholic community, who had been so excited that Pope Francis finally did something that was concrete, that was a concrete change that welcomed LGBT Catholics. But then only a few weeks later to see that kind of harsh language coming out again, it was a little confusing. So it's unclear. I think we'll have to see how this plays out over the coming months and years to see if Francis accomplished what he set out to do.
It was, like you described, a whiplash moment, and it remains to be seen where it goes. A couple months before that, we have the synod meetings in Rome. So, of course, the church is in the middle of this years-long process of synodality, which is attempting to make us more of a listening church. And yet, after last October's series of meetings at the Vatican, it was become known that there was not enough consensus among the participants for the document that came out at the end of that meeting, the synthesis document, to make any recommendations for greater inclusion and openness for LGBTQ Catholics. Do you think at all, Fiducia Supplicans anyway, like a response that from the Vatican and from Pope Francis, that the synod process in October didn't go far enough? Obviously, we have another roughly half a year and another series of meetings this coming October. So how does this all connect with synodality, do you think?
It's a great question. And I look forward to some enterprising Vatican reporter to kind of figure out, like, was this connected to the synod? I think that the Vatican tries to be somewhat strategic in how it addresses controversial questions. So I can't imagine it was done in isolation. We saw some fault lines come from both this synod that met last October and going all the way back, I think, to the Synod on the Family in 2014, 2015. There does seem to be a desire among some Catholics to have the church move forward to being a more welcoming institution. But you also have a fairly large, strong, and vocal contingent of bishops who think the church needs to double down on its traditional teaching when it comes to sexual ethics and sexual morality. And I think, again, this is showing that Francis is caught in this difficult place in how do you create a church of mercy while also upholding traditional rules around sexual ethics. I don't know where the synod will go. I think your question is spot on, though. How can LGBTQ voices be heard? I'm glad to see that there are advocates for greater LGBT inclusion, like Father Jim Martin, who are part of the proceedings. But when it comes to lay voices, I don't think there's much representation there. We're hoping, as an organization, to be able to highlight some of those voices ahead of next year's meeting, reach out to LGBTQ Catholics in different parts of the world and ask them to share their stories. I would love to put folks in touch with synod delegates and church leaders. But I think Francis has tried to model a way forward on this by meeting with LGBTQ Catholics who he is not chastising, not judging, not necessarily even kind of commenting on the moral nature of their life, but just encountering them as another human being. And I think that's a good way for church leaders to proceed, step back, encounter someone, listen to their stories, get to know them as a person before trying to teach and judge or condemn. So I don't know. I was a little skeptical going into October's meetings. I remain a little skeptical, but I think part of our vocation as Catholic Christians is to be people of hope. So I am hopeful that there'll be something good coming from these meetings.
Last year, we saw the U.S. bishops voted, I believe in June, to begin the process of revising the official directives for Catholic healthcare institutions, saying they should not provide gender-affirming medical treatment to transgender patients. And this was after the Bishop's Doctrinal Committee released a document that said roughly the same thing about healthcare institutions not providing that care. So what would you like to see as the bishops go through this process of revising the directives? And as some of them are also creating policies in their own dioceses and archdioceses that affect transgender students, employees, and others.
Yeah, I said earlier that Pope Francis has a difficult job trying to navigate some of the complexities and challenges in the church. And my friends who are leading Catholic healthcare institutions, working for different Catholic healthcare organizations, are also in a difficult position. There's a huge commitment up and down the administrative and medical teams at Catholic hospitals to really serve communities in need. And they do an amazing job. In rural places, Catholic healthcare is often the only option because they're willing to be located in places that maybe aren't as profitable, so they can't get kind of bigger hospital systems. They're really devoted to caring for the whole person. And generally, I think there's a lot of good people who want to serve their communities and do so every day. At the same time, there's been this rapid societal change when it comes to gender and sexuality, and there's been the need for healthcare systems to adapt and figure out what kind of care they can offer, what kind of care they're equipped to offer. And I think some Catholic hospitals are struggling a little bit to figure out how can we remain true to the church's teachings on these issues while also serving these communities. What I've heard from the folks I've interviewed, from transgender Catholics, from the parents and families of trans people in the Catholic Church, what I've heard is there doesn't seem to be much room for listening, that these policies seem to be created not through consultation with the people that they're addressing, but through consultation with perhaps lawyers or theologians who haven't really been in dialogue with this community that's being most affected by them. So I would love to see more of a space for, if not even dialogue, at least bishops and other church leaders listening to the folks whose lives, whose experiences are different from their own before these policies are promulgated.
Speaking of Catholic healthcare, your book, which I read and enjoyed immensely, Hidden Mercy, talked about a time when many in the church were not responding positively to LGBTQ folks. This is during the AIDS crisis of the 1980s and 90s. But you found stories of church leaders, and some of them were in healthcare, who were really responding positively. They were acting as the hands of Christ during that time. What did you learn while researching and writing your book?
Well, I appreciate all the kind words and the plugs for the book. I would say what I learned was the resiliency of the LGBTQ Catholic community, especially in the 80s and 90s. Friends and loved ones were dying. They were being ignored by the government. The Vatican was cracking down on gay and lesbian Catholics. Groups like Dignity were being kicked out of parishes. And while many LGBT Catholics left the church during this time, which is, I think, a scandal, the church kind of pushed them out, there was a core group of LGBT people who stuck around and said, no, that they're not going to be kicked out of their churches today. So one thing that has stuck with me was I have been fortunate in my life to be part of different Catholic communities that have been welcoming and affirming. And sometimes it feels like they've just always been that way. And I take it for granted that we had a great parish in Chicago that just had a totally accepting and welcoming and affirming culture that we felt welcome from day one. And I thought, oh, it's probably, that's just the way this parish is. And of course, it's not true. So I think I've hopefully been trying to encourage younger folks in their 20s and 30s to interact with older Catholics, learn what their stories were, learn what their struggles were, because it not only kind of respects the people who came before us, but also it at least gives me some hope and inspiration that even if there are challenges today, that we'll get through it and it'll be better on the other side.
Just a quick follow-up question. You mentioned younger people and younger Catholics. There's much discussion about younger Catholics not being affiliated with the church, the quote-unquote nuns. And for many of them, they cite church teaching or lack of openness about LGBTQ issues as a reason that they are not affiliated with the church. So what kind of challenge is that for the church, and what do you hope to see in response to that?
There's polls that show that people who leave Christianity in the United States, people who leave the Catholic Church, whether they're part of the LGBT community or not, they are citing the church's teaching and treatment of LGBT people as a reason for leaving. And I think that it is a wake-up call to church leaders. I hope it's a wake-up call to church leaders that even if there are doctrinal challenges that come with church teaching when it comes to how the church can be welcoming, at least adopting a pastoral tone that makes people feel included, like that can go a long way to helping people think that they can be part of this institution when their friends or loved ones are part of the LGBT community. At the same time, I always say when I'm meeting with LGBT Catholic groups, I don't think the church should be more welcoming to the community because it's going to bring everyone back, but because it's the right thing to do. It's what the gospel compels Christians to do, to be welcoming and hospitable to people, even if there are other disagreements. So I'm a little reluctant to say that the church should be welcoming and everyone's going to come back, because it's probably not going to happen, but we should be welcoming because that's the kind of church that we should have if we're reading the gospel closely.
Good point. Well, thank you so much, Mike. So happy to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Heidi.
This is David. Just want to say that if you want to listen to the entirety of this interview with Heidi, you can do so at our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/FrancisFXPod. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Heidi and Father Daniel, we'll be back in a couple of weeks. We're very glad to have been with you today. Thank you so much. This has been The Francis Effect. The Francis Effect is produced by Sandberg Media, LLC, and is recorded remotely in Chicago, Illinois, and South Bend, Indiana. It's edited by me at the William Adams Studios in Hyde Park on Chicago's beautiful South Side. The opinions of this program are our own and do not reflect the positions of any organizations with which we may be affiliated. We want to give a shout out to the Salt and Light Catholic Media Foundation. They are not affiliated with our program, but they did give us their kind permission to use the name The Francis Effect, and we appreciate it very much. Please check out their good work at slmedia.org. This show is made possible in part by our Patreon supporters, and if you'd like to join them, please go to patreon.com/francisfxpod. We appreciate it very much. Please follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Both of those are at francisfxpod, and our website is also francisfxpod.com. Please tell your friends about the show, and if you're here for the first time, we have seasons and seasons of episodes that you can go back to and listen to for your heart's content. We're so glad that you're here. Heidi and Father Daniel and I will be back in about 2 weeks. We're looking forward to being with you then. Thank you again for listening.